George Carlin, Richard Pryor, and Robert Klein have been called the holy trinity of stand-up of the post-Beatles era. Mr. Klein's comedy, a mix of observations about everyday life and musical performance, are on hilarious display in a four-disc DVD set of eight cable TV performances between 1975 and 2005 that's just been released. And Robert Klein, the HBO specials, brings him back to the show today. So it's a pleasure.
Thank you, Leonard.
Didn't you do HBO's very first comedy special?
I did. It was an idea invented by a man named Harlan Kleinman, who's now an investment banker in the San Francisco area. It was a Time Life project, home box office. They showed movies. They had about 400,000 subscribers in eastern Pennsylvania, Manhattan, and Long Island. Now they have 39 million, I think entirely due to me.
Sopranos didn't hurt, or Sex and the City?
Well, there would have been no Sopranos without a Robert Klein. He said, why not take a kid like Klein? That gives you some idea. It was actually 1975. To show me in my entirety and not in just the eight-minute pops that I would appear on Johnny Carson or Merv Griffin or Letterman. And I had a lot of college concerts then, so they sent an art director around to see the various venues and loved the one at Haverford in Bryn Mawr, you know, busts of old geezers, a woody auditorium, and thus the HBO On Location series was born.
So you just were recording the concerts that you were doing. Were you doing them with HBO in mind?
No. HBO recorded them. They decided to put me on for an hour. And there were no language restraints. I'm not particularly blue, but I'm a grown-up, and there were words that I couldn't say on Johnny Carson, or concepts that I couldn't present, because it would, you know, not being patronizing, would go past the audience. So eventually there were a couple that were 90 minutes. It was a great idea, and they never, ever, Leonard, interfered, asked me to change a word or of any kind, you know.
Well, these four DVDs cover 30 years of Robert Klein. I'm sure you looked back at the original ones. Are you pleased with 1975 Robert Klein?
I am.
Were there moments that you said, oh, gee, that was a really good bit. I forgot all about that.
Exactly. There were many of those moments. One of the interesting things about the eight shows and 9 hours of material that I wrote for them is that, of course, each time I was forced to write a new repertoire for HBO. I could do a joke at an industrial corporate date that I wrote 30 years ago, like, you know, my favorite George Washington. The guy risked, he's become an ossified statue. He's so fantastic. I mean, he was the essential person for the revolution. He would have been hung by the British had we lost. And I know he'd be proud to know we celebrate his birthday every year with a mattress sale. You know, well, I wrote that so many years ago, I can still do it. They haven't heard it. But for HBO, a new repertoire was required each time.
So George Carlin, what he does is every year he little by little, he changes the act so that by the time he has his next HBO special, he has a new act.
Well, George is actually much more prolific than I am. He sits at a computer and he writes it like a play. From the stage manager knows the first word and the last word, whereas I, with that kind of Second City influence, I mean, once I have improvised a bit and then sort of perfected it the way I want it, I'm not going to necessarily change a good laugh line, but I never do the same show twice. I never do it the same way twice.
How much of your character on stage is an invented persona, and how much of it is the guy who wisecracks at home when he's watching television?
None is invented.
We all invent a persona to some degree.
Well, I decided to make it pretty close to the belt, which is, I think, what caught the eye of Seinfeld and Billy Crystal and others, who said, well, wait a minute, here's a normal guy who's not shooting these cufflinks out of a tuxedo and doing joke, joke, joke. I think that was the essence of it, to be who I am. For example, my mentor, my Yale Drama School of stand-up, Rodney Dangerfield, there was a lot about that character that was true of him as a person, but he wasn't nearly that dumb. He wanted to be every man. I'll tell you don't know who to believe, you know? He was just confounded, but that was what they call in the business a hook.
And you did go to Yale Drama School. Actually, you have a degree in political science and history from Alfred University. Yeah. I assume your family wanted you to get a normal job, but how much has politics played? What kind of a role has it played in the development of your comedy sensibility?
I love to comment in my general performances around one of my albums, Mind Over Matter, had a very large Watergate content. I mean, that really got my hackles up.
But you never were a Mort Saul type comedian.
No, I mean, I always had political ideas, and I had to temper them for the networks. During the Vietnam War, for example, I had a summer show in 1970. They said, you know what happened to the Smothers Brothers, don't let that happen to you. Don't do the Vietnam jokes and so forth. The idea is, though, for my HBOs, stuff that's on the front page now will surely be quite old. So I want them to live. So when I do politics, I do it in more historical context. It can always be said that Bill Clinton is a historical tragedy. He is, after all, a brilliant man, a Rhodes Scholar, from the waist up. From the waist down, he's a high school equivalency diploma. Now, that can get a laugh properly for 20 years because people always remember that. It's not off the front page.
It is interesting that you mentioned the censorship that you experienced on the networks, because a lot of your material in the early days had to do with TV censorship. So you were thinking when you went to these, when you were doing these concerts or on HBO, that you could talk about them as a kind of a liberating experience.
Absolutely. You know, again, it is. I sort of am a little old-fashioned in that sense, not a prude. I rather decry the overwhelming ubiquitousness of profanity. It seems like Lenny Bruce's sacrifice was truly Christian. I mean, he was crucified and he had no champions, and his stuff is absolutely elegant when listened to.
Today he would be considered just a kind of a, well, not a middle of the road, because he was always brilliant, but he would not be the dirtiest comedian, that's for sure.
By no means. It's every other word, and I sort of feel that we sort of took the brunt of it. I mean, when I think of the conversations before every Tonight Show I had with Freddie DeCordova, who produced it for years, you know, well, you can't say Bobo. They'll know that's the genitalia. You know, they were ridiculous. I wish they could have been recorded.
And yet, Johnny Carson does strike me as one of the greatest interviewers of all time, and really did seem to go wherever you wanted to go. So it was really all censorship in your mind? He wasn't stopping you.
It wasn't him.
He loved those moments.
Yes,
didn't he?
As a matter of fact, I felt that they were pushing the envelope with these. When that large busted woman was his foil, you know, it was very burlesque like.
The Ed Ames bit is one of them, the classic Carson bits.
When the hatchet was thrown at the picture of him between the legs. I remember I had a pilot in 76 called Klein Time. It was kind of a Monty Pythonish thing, and we had this sex for television. We parodied the fact that we were not able to do what we wanted. And we borrowed this film from the UCLA biology department of paramecia reproducing, as you recall, Leonard. It's quite asexual. And, you know, they kind of
pull
apart. And underneath I sang, you know, and if you're wondering what this hall is leading to, I want to make it. And on Make It, it split apart. Well, I get a letter from what they called Continuity Acceptance, which was the censor at CBS at the time, saying this is unacceptable. The sexual innuendo is obvious. And I said, what kind of esoteric pervert is watching this and going, I love paramecia reproducing. Yeah, you know, I love it. Yeah, it's so beautiful.
I wonder what that censor thinks of shows like Two and a Half Men.
Well, everything evolves, you know.
Or devolves in that case.
Yeah, people that survive Pearl Harbor are driving around in Toyotas. Things change.
Well, what do you think about the sitcoms? Because you've often been critical of them. Do you think that there was a period where reality TV was supposed to kill the sitcoms, and now they've come back in full force?
Well, I don't think they'll ever be eliminated. I loved The Honeymooners. I loved Bilko. I have to say All in the Family was a wonderful sitcom. Fox was wonderful.
Predate your HBO specials.
Yeah, well, they're old. I was in a couple of series in the past few years. One with Jason Alexander, which tanked, and called Bob Patterson for ABC, and one with Judith Light called The Stones. I can't say that I could argue with either being yanked. On the other hand, I see stuff that's successful that's unwatchable. I mean, I much prefer to see, watch the History Channel. And by the way, I'm taping, Leonard, World War II. Don't tell me the ending. I much prefer the Nature Channel, the and ball games and dumb things like news talk shows. That's my own viewing habits. You know what? They'll always be around, and it's popular entertainment. What can I say? I can no longer complain. There are 170 channels. Read a book, man, if you can't find something.
By the way, there's...
Read my book, in fact. That's what I was here for last, The Amorous Busboy of Decatur Avenue.
There's a full DVD series on the war, so you don't have to tape them. But there's the full DVD series, in case you haven't been taping Robert Klein's appearances on... HBO, the HBO specials 1975 to 2005, 8 comedy specials on 4 DVDs covering 30 years.
75 to 2005. I'll be at J&R tomorrow at 12:30. And I admire them greatly, by the way, because they kept open after 9/11. I mean, they kept their employees on the payroll. They're wonderful New Yorkers. And I'll be there to sign these things at a nice reduced price. So show up and don't embarrass me.
You went, we said earlier, to Yale Drama School. Did you do that because you thought it would help you as a comedian, or did you also hope to get acting jobs?
As you mentioned, I was a history political science major at Alfred, but they had a wonderful but tiny drama department. And I participated in plays. And they hit my father with this prospect at the end of my junior year. Mr. Klein, he's talented. We can get him into Yale. My father said, Yale? You mean the Bula Bula Yale? They said, yes, that Yale. He said, did Eddie Cantor go to Yale to be an actor? He had a point, because it turned out that Second City, which was the start of my career 42 years ago in March of 65, making 150 a week, that was more valuable than Yale and the heavy tuition my dad paid. It set me on the right track.
You've done a lot of acting jobs. In fact, the Film Forum is showing The Landlord, which is my first film. And that you did a turn in blackface, which had to be rather daring, or even, I think, impossible today.
There was an interesting... It wouldn't be impossible, because he was an idiot in the context, so... there was an interesting article in the Times this week about it, that it started a trend. It was my very first movie. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's playing in the same house as my latest movie, Ira and Abby, which is a wonderful movie, got terrific notices, with Judith Light, Fred Willard, Jason Alexander, Jennifer Westfeld.
Back with Jason Alexander.
Yes, Jennifer Westfeld, who co-wrote Kissing Jessica Stein, wrote this, and it's a pip. I saw it at the LA Film Festival, and I saw it twice since. It's one of the favorite movies I've ever been in, and I've been in about 35 of them.
Well, you've been doing a lot of acting recently. Do you like acting out lines that someone else has written?
When they're written by Wendy Wasserstein and Terrence McNally and Neil Simon, I do. Theater, I don't think I'm going to be in the running for anymore. I'm too independent, and you have to show up 8 times a week. That's real work, Leonard. Movies, you do them, you work hard, and then they're finished, and they're there for the rest of eternity, it seems. So there's a kind of advantage to that.
Your later specials deal a lot with aging. Obviously something you've been thinking about. Has it been
Correct.
Weird for you to watch yourself age and looking at this collection?
You know, it is strange looking at me as a young man and these DVDs, many of which, by the way, are unseen. Obviously, people didn't have HBO then. But it reminds me when I had this talk show in 86, 87 on the USA Network. We were eventually canceled. I was not bitter. We were replaced by the real estate seminar. Lauren Bacall was
which
on.
Which was funny, actually.
Very, very funny. With no money down, you can buy a house. You know, Lauren Bacall was on, and she's always been a tremendous force for now is now, baby. You know, and she said it is strange being judged when you were 19 and lithe and gorgeous. And I have the same feeling. She's used to it. So since I've continued on quite actively, as she has, it's not unnatural for me to see a progression. It is a creative life on DVD. There's no question about it. It's pretty comprehensive roundup of the kind of stuff that's been coming out of my head for 30 years.
Which includes singing. Now, you, as we've discussed in the past, had your first brush with fame when you were on the Amateur Hour with your group, the Teen Tones. You were 15 at the time, and I suspect that's when you became hooked on performing. Well, maybe you already had been hooked by then, but you've continued to sing, and that has been a major part of your act.
I always use comedy and music. I write songs with Bob Stein, who's been with me for 23 years. We do a number of symphony dates, believe it or not, where I do the colonoscopy song with 70 pieces written for a symphony. I always believe that I love musical interludes in my work, but I make sure that the music is good and not just funny. It's my one problem with Mark Russell is that musically it's weak. Tom Lehrer's, I didn't mind.
Yeah, well, he did write songs like that you remember.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, whenever I've heard I Can't Stop My Leg, your famous song, it annoys me because for days afterward, it keeps on running through my head. How did you wind up with that song?
It started as a blues riff. The wonderful pianist at the Improvisation, which was the only club of its kind when I started there in the fall of 66, right at 44th and 9th, not there anymore. His name was Ray Johnson. He was a jazz pianist from Louisville. And I always played harmonica riffs and, you know, blues, and I love blues. And we began to do this, and my foot's stomping, and I'm just wailing on the harmonica, no words. Well, that old Second City habit of what's comes off your head. And the first lyric that came is the fact that my leg was going almost automatically, and I went, I can't stop my leg! And the audience just exploded. The way Paul Sills, the original director at Second City, used to say, when the audience laughs at improvisation, there's a special explosion. It's so unexpected. So I expanded it and expanded it, and eventually on one of the shows, Robert Klein on Broadway, I did it with chorus girls, and I can't stop my leg on Broadway, and then we did it hip-hop, I can't stop my leg, and then we did it most recently in Spanish, no puedo parar mi pierna, no puedo parar, with great Cubana dancers and El Salsa dancers, you know, so it's sort of a trademark.
Now, when you come up with a really good ad lib, do you always remember it? Because sometimes I'll tell myself, you got to remember that was really clever. And then, of course, I forget it. And maybe later that night I'll ask myself, what was that funny thing I said?
It happened to me last night. I saw the replay of Giuliani taking a call from his wife, right? Oh, hi, honey. Yeah, I'm in front of the National Rifle Association. Yes, darling. Well, what are you wearing? Yeah, and they went off into an obscene phone call. So, you know, I didn't write it down immediately, and I forgot it, and then it came to me an hour later. It took me a long time to realize to write these things down. That's what I do for a living. Eventually, these ideas come back into the head, and I try to record most of the shows I do.
Steve Allen used to walk around with a tape recorder.
I know. He wrote books that way, too.
Robert Klein, the HBO specials, 1975-2005, eight live comedy specials on four DVDs, now available in stores, and he will be at JNR tomorrow. There's also The Landlord, and then Abby and what is it again?
Ira and Abby. Got a nice
but
lovely reviews. It's a real New York comedy.
Thank you so much for being with
us
again.
Thanks, Leonard.